Muy buenas, hoy estamos en Charlas desde Sandland y hoy vamos a tener un contenido un poquito más especial de lo habitual, porque vamos a entrevistar a dos personas que no sé si conocéis, pero vais a flipar. Son Kevin Kalb y Emily Dressner. Son los dos autores de Espadas del Serpentino, que es el juego que tenemos ahora en preventa. ¿Que no conoces Espadas del Serpentino? Sandlands.es/serpentino, entras y miras toda la información. Pero básicamente es un juego de rol con sistema Gamsu para jugar espada y brujería. Muchísima acción, muchísima diversión y en general vamos a hablar de esto con estas dos personas. ¿Cuál es el pequeño problema? Pues que hablan en inglés, es lo que tiene ser ingleses o estadounidenses o lo que sea. Así que bueno, si estás escuchando esto en el podcast, te aconsejo que lo pares, que vayas a YouTube en la propia descripción de este podcast. Verás cómo llegar a YouTube, tendrás ahí el enlace y desde ahí lo puedes ver porque tendrás subtítulos y todo eso. Es una hora de conversación, vamos a hablar del porqué del juego, de cuáles son sus referentes, de qué es lo que se podría hacer con él, qué es lo que no se podría hacer, de qué es lo que están haciendo, qué es lo que van a hacer. Vamos a hablar de un montón de cosas que tiene que ver con este juegazo, que si no conoces, ya estás tardando. Así que nada, chicos, no me quiero enrollar más, simplemente quiero deciros que disfrutéis la entrevista. Hasta luego.
So thank you very much, Emily and Kevin, for this interview. It's an honor for me because I love to talk to a lot of authors and I love Gamsu, so this is amazing for me. So first of all, where would you want to start? Emily, Kevin, when do
you... Well, you should introduce yourself.
Well, Emily, introduce yourself to the audience, please.
Hi, audience. My name is Emily Dressner. I'm one of the authors of Sword of the Serpentine. I have been playing role-playing games since the 1980s. My probably all-time favorite role-playing game are old versions of Call of Cthulhu. I am pretty heavy D&D player. I play a lot of Shadowrun, which I happily admit. A lot of Chaosium systems. I do enjoy Gumshoe because I like the more investigative and thinking nature of a Gumshoe game, versus the slash and stab or the hide in a bathroom version of Cthulhu. I've been writing games since 1997. I've worked on a bunch of titles. I've worked for Steve Jackson Games, White Wolf, obviously Pelgrain, and a bunch of other people.
I'm Kevin Kalb. I also started running and playing games back in the early 1980s, which basically means that Emily and I are both really old. I started writing games and doing games work around 2000, 2001, something like that. With Pelgrane Press, I have written or co-written Owl Hoot Trail, which is their fantasy Western game. I was in Washington, D.C., playing at a gaming convention, playing a game of Knights Black Agents, the Super Spies versus Vampire Gumshoe game, when I thought, man, I wish there was a time travel game that felt like this. And there wasn't, so I wrote one. So that was Time Watch. And then I along with Emily, I'm the co-author of Swords of the Serpentine.
Okay, and we are talking about Espadas del Serpentino. It's the name in Spanish from Swords of the Serpentine, and we are going to translate. We are not sure about every single name of the game, but we are going to translate the big names. It's very common in Spanish, and we like the sound of these things. You can go to in this video in the you, we can have the URL to purchase the game from the Sandlands website. And why you make Swords of the Serpentine? I know, Kevin, you even make an entry for the blog of the Pelgrane blog. with this topic. So, Kevin, for you, why? Why do
Sure.
you?
So this is that, and there's a very specific start to the game. You know, we've gotten Time Watch out the door. I was walking my dogs, listening to a podcast from Ken and Robin talk about things, talk about stuff, where they were interviewing Epidia Ravakal, who is the author of the game Dread, which is the horror game with the using the Jenga tower. But he also did a swords and sorcery game. Emily, help me out. What's the name?
I actually have no idea
You
because
not have always. Oh, it's
I
on tip of my tongue.
don't
Anyway, doesn't matter. I'll tell you later. Anyways, it's a great game. And I was walking my dogs and I thought, oh boy, there's no way you can easily do a game like that in Gumshoe. And the reason for that is because historically, Gumshoe is really good at a lot of things. A thing that I love about it, in addition to the investigation, is that Gumshoe is good for people who are very good at their jobs. Really, the game system supports competent people who are good at their jobs, doing their jobs well. Which fits into swords and sorcery. But historically, the thing that it's kind of bad at is exciting combat. And so I'm walking my dogs and I'm thinking, oh, it's too bad you can never really make a good swords and sorcery game using Gumshoe. And by the time I'd finished the dog walk, I'd hit on the core mechanic that would make that really fun. And I was so distracted that I missed not one, not two, but three turns on my way driving home after that dog walk. And I reached out and I pitched Pelgrane on the game, and they were kind enough to say, yeah, this makes sense. We should go ahead with that. And as one does, whenever you need to write something, you should find a co-author who's better at it than you are, which is why I reached out to Emily. Because we knew that there are a lot of games that feel like Conan, right? And the very first version of this game felt a lot like a Conan game or a Conan story. But you know what? A lot of games do Conan really well. For instance, the game Conan. And so we thought it would make it a lot more fun, a lot more interesting to do something people hadn't done as much, which is make a strong swords and sorcery game that was set in a really interesting city. So that's how we first started.
And did you met before? Do you work together before this game,
We
or
hadn't
was it the
worked
first
together
one?
before, but I knew Emily through her work in a series of a post. Is it Dungeonomics?
Yeah, there's 56 of them.
Oh
Ask
my
me
God!
how I
Talk
know.
about Dungeonomics, please.
Yeah. So between 2014 and 2016, I wrote 56 highly meandering essays that were deconstructions of fantasy economics. The way D&D is set up, it doesn't really think about the implications of heroes very well, or their spells or spell reagents, or what a bunch of people traipsing around with huge amounts of treasure on the lands, like across the country, say, like what any of that means. So I started writing them on my personal blog. I wrote one that was really popular, that was how the identify spell ruins the world, because it uses pearls, but in like AD&D second edition, the pearls are actually consumed. In fifth edition, they fixed it, but if you go back to like third and second edition, now you consumed the pearl. So every time you identified something, you consumed a pearl, which meant that adventurers needed a steady stream of pearls to be able to identify their equipment when they come out of the dungeon. So it starts asking you questions like, where do the pearls come from? And then that sorts of leads you into really dark and spooky ways.
What if you're thousands of miles away from the ocean in a mountain range someplace? Where do you get your pearls? Huh.
Yes, like you've got like these guys who are of the divider class, and they're just standing there with buckets of magic grade pearls that they're selling for 100 gold pieces a shot. Where do the 100 gold pieces come from? And then where do the pearls come from? Just so you can identify these spells coming out of these dungeons. Where do these dungeons come from? So you spend a bunch of time thinking about this. We have some thoughts about publishing Dungeonomics as its own thing, but that would require me to do work, which hasn't happened.
Emily wrote a blog post on why diviners should rule the world.
Yes.
And that caught my attention. She was in one of the very first playtests of Swords of the Serpentine back before it was named, at a gaming convention for game designers called Metatopia here in the States. And based on that experience and our interactions previously, I knew that this was exactly the right person to do all the hard work that I wasn't smart enough to do.
My friends and I like to sit around and deconstruct games. Like we'll just get a game and we'll deconstruct it. I'm close friends with the folks over at Evil Hat. And so we go to Metatopia, go to these game conventions, and we like to sit on them and play these games and give the feedback to designers about where it is, where it's not, because gaming engines are a very delicate, balanced thing. And if the gaming engine isn't balanced well, the game falls apart and the game's not fun. And the whole idea is to get to fun. So we enjoy going to these conventions. I go to a lot of the board game ones to talk about like how is it balanced, how is it not balanced, where is it fun, where is it not fun. So when I played the first version of Sword of the Serpentine, I was there to tell Kevin that his game wasn't fun, and unfortunately, the game was fun, and that was its great downfall, is that the game turned out to be quite fun. We had a great time with the initial. There's a guy who was playing a servant. He was really a flesh sorcerer, and yeah, it was like some really good meaty stuff in there. And since I like breaking worlds and breaking games, it seemed like a good place to go break the world.
I had originally, long time ago, back in the 90s, had a city named Eversink, which is the name of the city in Swords of the Serpentine, in my campaign. And it was the first, I was that guy who always really wanted to have a good, interesting fantasy city and didn't really understand for a long time how to do that. That particular city in that D&D game was the first time I really felt I got it right. Highly political, built like an iceberg, and that there was much more of the city underground because it was gradually sinking over time. And so we recycled that idea, and I dropped it in Emily's lap to say, hey, here are my sort of rough thoughts about this, and here's what I think is really fun about this setting. Let's make something remarkable.
And then it broke it horribly.
When you start with the process, how do you separate your work? Like, okay, Emily is going to do the setting and Kevin is going to do the rules, or how was that?
Oh, I'd answer that, Emily. You want me to
You
say,
can
or do you
answer
want
that.
to? Because your perspective, I mean, so from my perspective, I had a vision which I shared with Emily, which basically said, hey, here's what I think the framework of this should be. Make it live. Then I focused almost entirely on the rules, other than giving, to be giving feedback or thoughts here and there, while she went and took the city and made it something really unique. Did that match your
Yeah.
memories?
Well, yeah. And then what you did is you said, "Hey, we got a city that sinks." And then I sat down and wrote several pages worth of notes of what is the implication about a city that's infinitely sinking. And most of my game design experience actually is all setting work, and I have a several references that sit in my game design library. Anybody who designs games has a whole shelf full of reference books that they use. And I do have a one book that is entirely a deconstruction of New York City politics, and which spends a whole lot of time on sewers, like an incredible amount of time on sewers. We talk about New York City politics, which was one of my references. And I have another one that is actually just the architecture of modern New York City, that does nothing but like break down the subway system and the where all of the like where the docks are located and how the roads are laid out and why the roads are laid out. It is, and the answer to that is Alexander Hamilton. That's another story. And so you start with references like real places that really have real people doing it, and you spend a lot of time thinking, all right, well, real people are going to live in this city. What is it that they need? Well, what they need is meat on a stick. So you have to make sure the city provides you meat on a stick. But like, people are going to live in different boroughs, and people are going to have different, there's going to be different economical zones, and there's going to be places that trade is concentrated, and where government is concentrated, where faith is concentrated. And then you just sort of start laying these places out. You start thinking about what the factions are going to be, and who's actually going to do what in the city, and who likes what. I was really taken by the old rich versus the new rich in Eversink, which was exasperated by the infinitely sinking buildings. So as this building sank for the old rich, the new rich were buying up the roofs and living out on top of them. So you literally had the old rich sinking into the ground slowly and painfully, living in their ragged purple silks, while these new rich on top are having big old parties. And on their condos that they built on the top of their buildings. And you're like, well, what the heck is the implication of that? And then you sort of spiral out from there. You end up with having lost libraries underground or lost serpentine underground that have sunk thousands of years ago while people are busy buying up tenements and gentrifying on top of it. And so you end up getting these interesting layers in Eversink. It's a very three-dimensional place.
Important thing about the book design is that every single location that we mention, every thing we talk about the city is a plot hook. And this is really deliberately. We went through it and said, okay, this thing, it's boring. We don't need it. Toss it out. So by design, when you read the book, every location that's talked about, we give you tools to help set an adventure that involves that thing. I think that makes it much easier to run games in the city. Because big cities, like fantasy cities, that's intimidating. That's hard to do for someone who's never done it before. So the more things we can do to make it fun, interesting, exciting, the better.
In fact, how was that? It's like, okay, Emily has an idea of like a neighborhood, and you start doing plot hooks for that, or it was the other way around, or it depends. You had like a few items you want to know to put, and then start filling it. How was the process in that way?
Landmarks. Landmarks are very important. There are people who do setting books, which are really, they detail all the small stores on a given street, stuff that is useful to know if you're trying to make a simulation, but doesn't really help make your game better. We were really clear that this wasn't a simulation, it was an emulation, meaning that we wanted it to feel like a really exciting thing. If you were reading a book of fantasy short stories, you don't care what the address is for the local tavern, right? Or the blacksmith that you go to buy your armor. You just need to know that there's somebody around and how to make that as interesting as possible. And so when we designed the city, we thought, if you were a tourist who was coming here, what are the things that you would remember? What are the things that you would use to navigate around the city? And that's, I think, where we started.
And
Yes.
I'm very interested for the professions, because the professions have their own abilities, so it's very tailored in the system. How was that? This was like, okay, I want that professions. Now we are going to put it in the system or the other way
Let's talk rules for a second. And
around?
before I'm going to answer your question, I'm going to talk about a lot of other stuff first before I answer your question. Okay.
Okay.
So, Emily, throw something at me if I get boring. Okay.
Okay.
So, Gumshoe is broken down into two different, yes, that's exactly, two different types of abilities. You have your general abilities, which is how you get stuff done. When you attack someone, you're rolling a warfare test, and that uses a die. You also have investigative abilities, and investigative abilities always work. In core Gumshoe, they're used to get you information, and really not a whole lot else. The realization that Emily and I had is that you could use your investigative abilities to help drive combat to be really interesting and to give the players more narrative control. One of the things that has slowly crept into other Gumshoe games is that you can spend those points to get some sort of advantage. For instance, in Time Watch, which is a time travel game, if you want to get into a place that there's a security guard keeping you out, you can say, "Oh, I'm going to go back in time. I'm going to become this guy's best friend in college, and then I won't see him again for 15 years until I show up outside the door right now." And mechanically, all I do is spend one point of charm to establish that I have a friendship with him, and all the rest is just player explanation that makes it more fun. And we realized that we could do this in Swords of the Serpentine, but also you could use those investigative abilities for professions to really give a particular, in D&D it would be a character class, right? But it's much looser here, but to create those fantasy archetypes of a thief or a sorcerer or a warrior or some sort of inquisitor or guard. And you could spend those points to do more damage in combat, which at the same time would make combat a heck of a lot more fun and a lot more interesting. And so when we were building the game, we thought, well, let's think about socially, what are the ways that you want to be able to communicate, how you're interacting with the non-player characters, and what are the abilities which really define who you are. So for instance, for sorcerers, it's what is it? It's corruption, which is used to power your spells because none of the magic comes from a good place. And it's prophecy to be able to see the future and see the past. And it's leechcraft, which means that you know how medicine and poisons and diseases work. And it's something else. I forget what the other thing is. But by giving people fewer abilities that do more things, we make sure that people never feel bad about selecting those abilities. Does that answer your question?
Yes. So, do you start in the playtesting? You start like, okay, they are going to have the same abilities, and then you start with this separation of abilities for every profession, or how was that?
We wanted to make it so that you could play somebody who was really specialized, or that you could create your own sort of fantasy archetype, your fantasy concept of a hero who had abilities from all over. And that it was, we wanted to encourage one, but not like make it lock it down. So you get a slight advantage if you decide to specialize in a particular profession, like 1 point extra out of 10 or 11 points, something like that. And we tried to pick the most flavorful thing we could. We went through a lot of options that were boring and we threw them out. So, for instance, if you're a thief, the options are scurrilous rumors, which means that you hear all the rumors that are happening in the city about the thing you want to know. If you think about Game of Thrones, Littlefinger had an awful lot of ranks of scurrilous rumors because he was the spy master who everybody reported to. And you could spend those points not just to gain information, but also to either improve or ruin someone else's reputation because you could spread gossip about them, right? There's an ability that means that you know the city like the back of your hand, and you can use all the secret forgotten tunnels underground in order to get from one place to another. There's an ability called Skullduggery that says, "Hey, this is how I find out information through illegal means." And if you have ranks of Skullduggery, maybe you are blackmailing someone for that information. Maybe you snuck into their home and you stole it from their personal diary. Maybe you shadowed them through the streets to find it out. Whatever the reason, if you have ranks of Skullduggery, you can find out information through illegal means. And the last one is ridiculous luck, because sometimes you just want a hero who is absurdly lucky. But we kept it at four per profession because we didn't want to overwhelm people. We wanted a few really flavorful choices that had a broad range that they could be used in.
Emily, when you are seeing the rules, it's very easy to see that the setting is going to be broken in a multiple ways when you are playing, because I am playing, I am saying, okay, I'm spending this point on the and on this. And I'm going to, and from now on, the city is going to have this, because I, as a player, that's okay for you. It's because I know some authors that don't, I hate that. They want to have like all the I make this have to be this way. You make room for these possibilities, or how was
So
this approach?
the setting is the room for fun, right? That's its entire job, is that it's the way that we can carry the flavor of the game that we want to play if we want to play in that setting. And it's starting conditions. You can use the setting, you could not use the setting. You can burn the entire city down. It's just
Have.
And Kevin burns it down on a regular basis.
Okay.
Sometimes he rebuilds it and then maybe he doesn't. But these things are okay. If we're going to use a setting that's in a book, if we're going to use Sword of Serpentine or Blades in the Dark or something else that has a well-developed setting, then we think of these things as the starting conditions, right? Of that's like the opening conditions of where things are and where we can find things and how we operate in this world. But like settings, games aren't static, and games are whatever the table wants them to be. And if you want to add things to it, remove things to it, move the city in time, you
Okay.
invade it
Wait,
with
raise an
serpent.
island, sink an island.
Yeah, raise an island, sink an island. Like these things are all fine, right? It's whatever people want it to be.
One of the things I love most about your work, Emily, is that you left so much space because players in this game have more narrative control than they do in some other games. So I can spend a point of forgotten lore, which is one of the sorcerer profession abilities, in order to establish a fact is true. Or I could spend a point of laws and traditions to make up a law on the spot that is always true from that point forward. And p players can do that, and they can just make stuff up about the city, which now is a fact, and that the GM now has to incorporate into what they're doing. And I love that you created a setting which really embraces that and is designed to help ad adjust to it.
I also assume that everybody lives in that city is crazy. So if you come and you add something new, is anybody going to notice? Hard to tell.
Whenever I play a character who has ranks in the ability Laws and Traditions, every game that I haven't already spent it, I spend a point to make up a new fashion law. So, oh, this week, like beards are out and everybody has long curly mustaches, or no one wears mustaches anymore, but all of the shoes have a point on the end, right? Like every game, I try to change the fashion just because I can. And then I make fun of the other, my character makes fun of the other players who aren't keeping up with the fashions, you know.
Hat laws. You gotta
That's
have
right.
hat laws.
That's
Yeah.
right.
It's what it's there for.
I make a few games with other co-created a few games, and the hardest part for me is to set the tone, because I have my game in my head, the other person have his or her game in his head. And I like to talk a lot about the reference. Like, okay, this is going to be, I don't know, Matrix in the medieval times, for example. It's like a particular tone. You make something like that, like this is our inspirations, because you are talking about Conan. In the book, you talk about a lot about this world, landmark, and a few more social sorcery books. It was like a Bible for you, like we're going to set these tones, we're going to target this, or this was like more like I want something completely new, and we are going to forget about this.
We had a list that was one of the first things that I wrote that we used as our Bible for setting the tone. And it's things like, and in the English book, it's on page 201. And it's things like adventures are episodic and months or years may pass between adventures. The actions of the heroes change the world around them in fundamentally important ways. The heroes' own abilities are more important than any items they might carry. Sorcery is rare and dangerous, and can't be trusted. Sorcery corrupts and has a cost. Not all secrets in the world should be known, or they don't need to be known. Stuff like that, right? So we, Emily and I came back to this again and again and again, because we'd add something and then we'd say, well, does this match the tone that we want? And if the answer was yes, then great. And if the answer was no, then we change it so it would. And I think that's really important, right? Because one of the things that I think that we helped create together was that the city really has a very unique feel compared to some places. And that's because we knew going in exactly what we wanted it to feel like. We tried to explain this in a couple of different ways. One way we tried to capture the tone is I'm a big believer in examples as we look at rules. So there's examples throughout the rules, and all of those examples are also communicating tone.
Yes,
And
I love that in the book because I think in every single ability is like a box text with an okay, this is like Lord of the Rings. This is like and I think it's very graphic. You are reading the book and you are knowing how to I love that from the for that book.
I think those help, right? Those little sidebars that say, this is why we chose this, you can change it, right? Go ahead and change anything you want to. It's your game, not our game. But you should know why we chose it. And that gives the people playing the game the understanding they need to know what they want to keep and what they want to throw away.
Do you when the game came out and then the people start playing it and talking about it and then the Ennis Award start talking about you how it's something you I think I don't know how to to ask this but do you expect having this kind of reward with the awards or with the Ennis nominations, or is like, okay, this is my shit and I
Really,
put
you
it by the
talk about
word.
this.
Absolutely no. I absolutely no. I had no expectations whatsoever. Like the entire point was to put something fun out into the world that our community enjoys playing. That was the entire point, is the whole motivation is can we build something that's fun that people enjoy taking off the shelf and playing around their table? If the answer is yes, then that's a successful story. It's a success. Anything else that comes with it is I'm grateful for them. I really appreciate it. But like the goal was to make joy for other people, and I think that we met that goal.
Yes.
The things that helped us there is that it had a very long playtest cycle. I mean, one might argue that one reason we had a long playtest cycle was the pandemic, and the other reason is that I think that I'm a good writer, but I'm not a super fast writer. Emily's much faster than I am, but we kept playing it sort of nonstop before there were any rules written down. We were already starting to run some playtest games, and so we were able to figure out which parts were really fun and which parts weren't. For instance, at one point we had a really complicated system in there, and a really interesting system for diseases and curses, how to catch diseases, what all sorts of cool diseases. You know what the game is not about? Getting sick. So
Getting
we
sick.
threw it all away. Right?
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that playtesting does for you. It stops you from making stupid mistakes.
Yes, I would say that it's when you're building a game and you're playtesting it is extremely important to listen to the feedback of the players. You can get in your head that this is my baby and they don't like something and I'm not going to cut it, but that's always the wrong decision. The right decision is to always have the empathy with your players who've come to the table and give, they're spending their own time to give you feedback on your game. Feedback is a gift. And like if they come back and say, yeah, this thing's not fun, out it goes. And you're like, well, it's just text. I can write more of that. And you cut it. And so all that's left is something that people want to play. And that's the goal. Making something people want to play requires bringing a lot of empathy for your players to the table and understand that it's not about you, it's about them, and you're building something for them.
Mechanically, I think this game does some really neat things for the Gumshoe system. One is social combat. So, because I wanted a game that like some stories that I love, you could play a hero who never touches a weapon and still be equally effective in combat. So that was one thing. We wanted sorcery to be really flavorful. And we added this cool system called maneuvers. And I added maneuvers in, and the one thing that playtesting showed us when other people were running the game is that they were terrible and did not work. And I had, Emily probably remembers this, I had about a week of stomping around going, what are they saying? They're wrong. And before I actually listened and said, oh no, they're absolutely correct. And I am very wrong. And we rewrote it so that they were really fun. And once we did that, we realized that I had to rewrite another three chapters because they were so much fun. If I carried that mechanic over into other things, it would make all of those chapters better too. So I then rewrote all the section on traps, and I rewrote all the section on sorcery,
Oh, yeah,
and
the sorcery thing. How many, like, sorcery itself got many, many, many rewrites. I love corruption. I love the corruption system. But, like, as I said when we started this off, games are very careful balance, and you want to, like, balance between your ideas and what is fun. I love the thought of you casting a spell, and then you've got this ball of corruption that's got to go somewhere. And maybe it goes inside you, or maybe it goes into some other person right there, or the nearby tree, and now the tree falls over. Like nothing good comes out of sorcery in Sword of the Serpentine, but it has to work, and it has to be fun, and it has to
fun,
be
yeah.
flavorful. It can't just be a cool idea.
Okay, when I look into the credits of the book, it's separate your work. Setting is from Emily and Kevin, but system is from Kevin and Matthew Breen. Who is Matthew Breen and?
Matthew Breen is he's fabulous. So he is from New Zealand. He is an eighth Dan black belt in Taekwondo who helps train New Zealand's Taekwondo team.
Okay.
He's a computer technology guy. He's better at more things than almost anyone else I know, and is one of the kindest people I know. Matt, ever since I originally met him back when we were both moderators on Russ Morrissey's website, EN World, which handles the role-playing game news. I was an administrator there for many years using the name Pirate Cat, as was Matt. And throughout the games I've written, he has often been my sort of, I joke that he's my muse in the sense that he's a great person that I can bounce rules things off of. He thinks about rules very differently than I do. And so whenever there's something I'm curious about, usually between the two of us, we can figure out why it won't work or what would make it more fun. So, and like Matt's not super interested in writing a big chunk of this. I think his fun is in playing around with the ideas as associated with it. But I want to make sure that he understands exactly how valuable he is to me, both as a friend and as a co-writer, because gosh, he's good. Yeah.
Okay, I have a question because when I'm reading the book, it's very easy to see that you had a lot of fun writing this, but when I'm l reading the setting, it's like there is this city in this world. It's like a very foggy world. It seems like a lot of landmark novels, which the world is almost empty. And that was an approach for giving space to the players to feel that, or this is like, no, I don't want you to go out of everything ever again.
No. Go ahead, Emily.
I could talk about the world a bit. So the world came very late in development as well. But the focus of the game was the city of Eversink. It wasn't the city of Eversink plus, like Paris and Madrid and Barcelona. It was the city of Eversink. And so didn't put a lot of that heavy effort and time into the wider world. If I was going to sit down and write a wider world, I would populate the entire world with cities and roads and villages and places to go and things to see. But for the core book, for the core vision of the book, we envisioned the adventures to be in the city of Eversink and its immediate environs.
Yeah. If you think about a fantasy novel that you pick up, and there's that map on the front pages of the fantasy novel that shows the whole world, and the stories are only taking place in one city, but you look at that whole world and you think to yourself, I wonder what else is out there, right? It's kind of the feel we wanted. We didn't have the page count. We had to cut 100,000 words out of the book in order to
Okay. That's a lot
about
of
that, about 100,000 words, I'd say. That's all sitting there waiting to get published at some point. And so we didn't have the page count to spend a lot of time on the rest of the world, but we wanted to give people, hey, here are flavorful, interesting areas in the world with strong themes. So you can be like, cool, like that's the place that's like Russia with a bunch of witches and ice, and a lot of snow and ice. This is the place where they're working on steampunk devices, stuff like that, so that other players could and GMs could build those things themselves as they were running their game. And so if we ever wanted to expand stuff, we can. I just finished my 6-year-old campaign. We just drew it to a close finally after 6 years. And the next campaign is being set in one of those other countries. So it's going to be really fun for me to help to build all that out and to learn what's actually there.
In that way, it remind well. I want to show you something. This is, I don't know if you know what this map is. Is Ankh-Morpork.
Of course, it's not more quark. Yeah, I recognize the river. Perfect.
Yes, I have a huge map of the, of Ankh-Morpork in my room. This is from this to this. This is all the Terry Pratchett books. I love them. I'm a very fa I'm a huge fan of his work, and when he's making this work. He have Ankh-Morpork, he have the big cities like Eversink, and then he don't make a lot of countries, but he make Lancre, he make a few things and build big cities. Well, Lancre is not big, but the environment is big, and you can play only in Lancre, only in Ankh-Morpork. And I think this could be great for Swords of Serpentine because it feels that way. And when you are talking about this, it's like, ooh, I want to know about.
You know that this is the secret game design for Swords of the Serpentine was so that we could run a Discworld game, right? Like 100%.
Thank you. Thank you
All of
for
the
that.
politics system in Swords of the Serpentine are inspired by Terry Pratchett's work in Discworld, where if you think about Discworld, you've got these political factions, right? There's Lord Vednari in the government. There are dwarves and there are trolls. There's the city watch. There's the nobles. There's the commoners. And each of them sort of bump against each other in the stories. And that's what creates the drama. And we wanted a system where the players could be allied with one or two of those political factions and have another one that's really angry at them, because those are the sort of hooks which help create adventure.
Emily, you have in your own blog, you have an article about the postal system of EverSync.
I don't think I did anything.
You know,
The post office, the post office.
didn't you write a blog post, Emily, about
Oh.
EverSync's postal system
Yes,
or something like that?
the EverSync post office.
I have here. Here's the reality: is I have written hundreds of thousands of words in my life, and I, honest to God, do not always remember all the things that I've written. So I'm going to give that a hot maybe.
During the
Maybe
pandemic, and it
what
was
I,
really
it's a
good.
fact. It's a fact. You
That's a
can see.
fact. Oh, I did. Yes, apparently I did write a whole thing about the phone service
I
one time.
found
So I'm glad you found it, because I can't remember what I did yesterday, let alone what I wrote
Okay.
a couple years ago.
Okay. So I the question is going to be about this is going postal. But you
I
don't
love
remember.
going postal. I love going postal. It is my favorite of all of the Discworld novels.
Okay, so that's
By
a hard
far.
yes.
Yeah, it's a hard yes.
Emily, this woman I know
It
named Emily
says in
Dresner
here.
wrote an article about the postal system in EverSync. You should go read it. You'd like it.
I would probably, yeah, I would
I'm
enjoy.
sorry to interrupt you, Alvaro.
Apparently, I wrote it at some point in time, and it's not sitting in my GitHub archive, so I don't have it in my act on my list.
It says an unofficial supplement. It's like
Yeah, just
why is unofficial? Because you
because
don't.
I just published it on Critical Hit. That's why.
Okay, but it's for me. It's official. It's canon for me. It's
Yeah, but
that's right.
yeah, but I wrote it.
Okay. Kevin, you just said that you want to make this work a Discworld game in a sort of Discworld game. Have you tried in the playtesting to go full comedy, like the first novels of the first Terry Pratchett novels? You try to force it, like I want this to be very, very funny.
Comedy game is defined by the players, not by the setting, I think. I find that settings that are designed to be funny often fail. If you take the funniest game that I know of is Paranoia.
Yes.
Paranoia is very, very funny, and that's in part because it can take characters who, like, it's dead serious. Their life is on the line, and put them in completely ridiculous positions. Where they have to be very serious while horrible things are happening to them. You know, I haven't played a really comedy version of Swords of the Serpentine. I think you could, and I think it would be really fun, but it's not the kind of thing which I lean towards usually. And with the right players, it would be fantastic. I've got a group that I play superhero games with. You could I tried to play a really serious game with them, and literally that tone lasted for 45 seconds before it turned silly. So you know what? They'd be great at that.
Okay.
Yeah.
The next question will be if you are willing to do a comedy adventure, but I think for your answer, I think that's not in your plate.
Know what it would look like. It's a really interesting question. I have to think about it. I think you could do a comedy adventure, or one that sort of is set up to be really silly or really funny, but I'd have to think about how I would structure that. Yeah, I'm better with horror than I am with comedy, I suspect. Horror I can do really easily.
In Spain, we have a few games, a few Spanish games, and one of the earliest and the most famous is Fun Hunter. Fun Hunter is a set of comic books where the Pope rule invade all Europe and control all Europe, but the Pope is controlled by the ghost of Philip K. Dick. So it's very weird, that's very funny, and I love that game. And it's built to make comedy, and I think you could do it. It's very fun. And you should
I'll
try
think
it.
about it.
You should try
I
it.
can
You
see a
should try it.
CPage XX article about it.
Okay, I'm looking for it. Okay, we are going to we are we're finishing now. So, what are the next steps for Source of Serpentine? Because you have the first supplement that it's a few adventures, but now what are you going to do?
A couple things. We are publishing for free on the website and on the Patreon, and they'll probably put them together at some point. Rules for Non-Human Heroes, where we started out with non-human heroes who would fit well into Eversync. For instance, playing an intelligent animal, or a gargoyle, or a sea creature, that sort of thing. We want to give people options, and I'm starting now. Will be over the next year or so, you'll see rules to use the same set of rules for Swords of the Serpentine, but with high fantasy instead. So, how you would structure an elf or a dwarf or a hobbit or, what have you, right? And those are really fun to do because you can put a lot of flavor in and it expands the number of people who want to play the game because not everybody loves swords and sorcery. But the rules and the setting is so good, I'd like to see more people, even more people pay attention to that. If I had not had a pandemic, I would already have the rules out. Like we outlined and wrote part of a really big five adventure series, and I ran into a problem with sort of how the structure went on that. So that is on hold right now, and I think that I'll be finishing it up after the current project I'm doing. Gareth Rider Hanrahan is writing a Swords of the Serpentine adventure.
Ooh.
I am working, and we're finishing up the GM guide, which is basically a GM companion full of advice and ideas and additional ways to make the game rules really sing. I think there's a lot of places where we could go, right? I've pitched like a bestiary with lots more monsters, that sort of stuff. I'll have lots of material for expanding the world to a different country based on the fact that I'm setting my next game in a different country. And so all that stuff will naturally accrue. Mostly it's a question on time, right? I have my main job is doing shift work consulting. I travel around the country helping people who work night shifts in factories all over. Emily is a CTO and where she had more meetings today than I did. She had six meetings. I only had five. All right. So the being able to, there are people who write full time who are really good at that. I'm kind of bad at it. And so most of my writing time happens on weekends and in evenings and what have you. So I get there. It just takes me longer than it should. So we're getting more people. Like, well, I'm really happy that Gareth is coming on board to help write stuff because he's very fast. And so he'll get adventures out faster than I will.
And you are going to work together for all, I don't know, I you said five books? I know
Oh no,
anymore.
so it was a series of chained adventures. One adventure leads into the next, leads into the next, that sort of stuff. And as soon as I solve the big plotting problem, I think that it's a go. I just have what I thought was going to work. This is why you play test, right? Ran into a brick wall. So we'll get there.
And Emily, are you planning to do something more for Swords of the Serpentine?
Well, if there's a project that comes up, I'll hop on it. It turns out adventure writing is not my strong suit. We will leave the adventures to Gar, that is his strong suit, and we should just do it. If something comes up, I'd be happy to jump on it. I'm starting to have thoughts about other projects. I'd really like to work on a cyberpunk project. And I know what the setting and what the format of that should be, but I need to get it out of my head. And I'd really like to publish Dungeonomics.
We have 70,000 words or so that you wrote on factions that
Oh,
we
there's
took
that
out, right?
too. Yeah. So
So,
I wrote an
you know,
entire squad on factions if you
that's
want to
right.
buy faction stuff.
But
That's right.
you need to publish that. It's a lot of
Yeah,
work.
I'm gonna
Yeah,
talk to
there's
our
the
editor and figure and get that into the thing, because that's, you know, most of the hard work there is done.
Yeah, it's like I was writing Sword of the Serpentine, I essentially wrote an entire supplement that was nothing but factions, and different and how the factions interact and the whole thing on like every faction has how they feel about every other faction and how they work, all the politics of the city in a huge, huge, huge amount of probably overwhelming detail. It's still sitting in a Word document. It needs to be edited into a book. So if you're interested in that, let us know and then we'll.
I picked actually we took a big chunk we took chunks of that and put it fit it into the main book as much as we could, but there's so much that's so good
There's,
that yeah,
yeah. I went
please
into a
please do
hole
it,
for like 6 months.
please, I'm begging you, please, you have to do it now, like quit your job and do it. I don't
Talk
know.
to your manager I can't quit my job just to work
Please.
on splats. As much as I would enjoy quitting my job and just working on splats and writing weird games about AIs, I can't quite do that right now. So I'm in the same boat as Kevin is, which is everything is like weekends and evenings.
And this whole setting is we have talked about it later. That it's like a work in progress. The GM is going to change it. The players is going to change it. So you are you would like to any other person like Gareth or something like that make a more setting for this game, or you would like to oversee it?
I will always write setting if Kevin showed up and said, we need to design this. Here's my notes. Go design this society. I'll go in a hole and like 9 months later, a splat will show up with this entire society. So if that happens, like that will have that be, I will do that because that's what I enjoy doing. But all right, we're not.
I am I'm very careful about the tone of adventures and a little bit less about world design, right? In that Swords of the Serpentine adventures feel really different than a D&D adventure. What the game is about how your actions change the world and how the world changes you. And because the game is very closely tied to social combat. A lot of things in D&D you would solve by killing somebody and taking their stuff doesn't work that way here. So I'm a little careful about sort of being clear about what our expectations are there. But like seeing additional world design and stuff, like bring it on. One of the reasons that we wrote this is we love to watch what other people do with the work that we've done, and hearing stories about how they've expanded it and what people have decided in their own games. There's some really important questions, including why the city is sinking, that we chose not to answer in the book because it turned out to be much more interesting to give people options and let them decide for themselves.
Okay. And novels or something like that inside this setting, you are planning on something, on doing something like that?
I'm sorry, something like
Like a novel or a short fiction?
novels.
That's a question for Pelgrane. I don't know.
Okay.
I think that you could have an awful lot of fun with novels set inside this setting, but I also think that the fan base for the more specific you go, the fewer number of people are going to buy that, right? So a novel overall is going to sell more than a novel about a particular setting, I suspect. But I think it's rich for that. Like, there's a lot of really good stories you can tell with the stuff that Emily's created.
So I don't know. I don't have many more questions. I don't know if you have something more to say, like buy my book or something like that.
Well, I'd say take a look within by the end of the year. I hope to have the GM companion out, and that should be an awful lot of fun. It'll come with a GM screen, but also just 25,000 words of good advice and strategy for running the game and making it more fun. We try to get every month or two an article on cpagexx, which is Pelgrane's online blog about the game. So we'll continue to publish free material there as we
The
go along.
free materials is always put like playtesting. Is in all the entries of the blog, you said this is playtesting because you are planning to do like a book with all of that
Like to.
material.
Yeah, I'd sure like to. I think that you could easily have a book of like those non-human hero archetypes, really easily, and just put them together. But we need to make sure that they all work.
I signed myself for writing up a page XX article that I really should write, like ASAP, which I think would be fun. They're talking me into starting to write a bunch of stuff about divination and prophecy in Eversong. And it's a very, very rich topic, especially if we can like, do some horoscopes and look at some, goat livers and try to predict the future. Which I think it's very important because after you predict the future, extremely tasty. So it's a whole divination to table pipeline going on in Everson.
One of the things I love, Alvaro, is that if you have ranks of prophecy, the player gets to decide how that is expressed. So one person, you might decide that you have visions that see someone else might Emily might look into her tea leaves and see that. But the idea of having to sort through goat livers and goat entrails on the ground after a sacrifice is a perfectly solid way to respect that in the game. So I like that we have that kind of flexibility.
Okay. I have just one more question. Have you tried Gareth Rider Hanrahan's Shrines Out? Do you know Shrines Out?
I
I don't know.
haven't.
I don't know if I'm saying it right, but it's the new his upcoming game. It's published in the Pelgrim Press, and it's like a Knives Out movie
Oh.
with hobbits. It's a murder mystery with hobbits, and when
That's
they went to they came to Spain the last year, and I play test this game, and it was hilarious. It was amazing. It was very funny. And if you don't if you didn't try that game, you should talk to Gareth and say, okay, you have to GM this.
was amazing. And I gotta say, like you're a bad person because now I'm thinking about how you would make a comedy adventure, like, and it wouldn't be that hard.
Have to do it.
I
It's
got other
easy.
things to finish first, okay?
No. You do that this and then. For example, in the GM GM advice about comedy in the it's you can put it there.
I'll think about it. That's an interesting thing, and probably worth doing. All right, it's on the list.
Okay, so thank you very much. It was amazing talking to you, and I think your game is going to be very famous in Spain. I hope so.
We're so proud and so grateful. That you're publishing us in Spanish. I would never have, like, when we were building this, the idea of other people playing our game, especially in other countries and in other languages and stuff, would never have occurred to me. And I'm really excited.
Yes, I'm excited too because I think it's a very fun, funny book. It's very easy to read it, and it's full of plot hooks and graphic examples of things. And I think everyone is going to love it. So thank you for this book.
Can't wait to see it.
Yep.
Emily, thank you. Thanks to you. Thanks for your post office.
You can use the post office. I'm glad somebody remembers that I wrote something once. I'm super excited for
Start of the pandemic was really hard, man. Forgot a lot of stuff.
And I hope you find more time for this, for exploring this setting, because it's amazing. Thank you too. Thank you to for all the person that it's still watching this, because it's a long conversation. And again, thank you very much.
Yep. Thank you for having us.
Bye. Hello. Bye.